Last week I left you with a comment about Melchizedek and identification of him, which is no big deal. This is nothing we fight about, nothing that's very, well, I wouldn't say it's not important, but it's not that kind of issue. And so what I was going to do, I was going to say something that I didn't say last week about that. And before I knew it, I had a whole lesson done on it, which is the way, you know, you and me have been together for a long time, is that when I get an interest in a subject, I got to finish it up, because otherwise I won't come back to it again. And even though I've had a view of Melchizedek as being, you know, not provable, obviously, I've always never done a lesson on it to argue it or show the reason why or the weakness of it and so forth. So since I think Melchizedek is a very, very significant person, in fact, so significant that Hebrews picks him up as a type of, or not a type of, or a beginning of the order of Melchizedek, a new order of priesthood, precedes Aaron, before Aaron, and he becomes the priesthood that Jesus Christ in the kingdom will find himself patterned after, because the Melchizedekian priesthood can also be a king, which is not possible in the Aaronic priesthood. So I'll talk about that a little bit. And like I said, this is not a food fight. It's not that kind of thing. But I did want to go through it, at least for myself, to present the ideas. Now, what I have on the board, this is a... So this lesson has to do more with how to study than maybe, not more than, but also has a component of how we read our Bible, how we study the Bible, how we come to the conclusions we do, what kind of evidence do we have to have, what kind of weight do you give to different kind of evidences and different kind of authorities and so forth. And one of the things that I think we all have, whether we know it or not, we have a system that we understand that God's working out of. You know, he's doing something in this world. We may have that right, we may have it a little bit wrong, but we have a system. That's really what I have on the board here, is that God didn't decide in the morning when he created Adam, said, I wonder what's going to happen to what my creation. He knew everything all down. And not only did he know everything down, he also caused certain things to happen that would be useful. And I put on the top over here, these are pedagogical, means learning, teaching moments to learn about man and God. And I think that was one thing we want to always be aware of, that when we study the Bible, we're going to learn about these two people. One, we're going to learn about ourselves, who we really are, and we're going to learn, more importantly, what God is like. And we do that by watching what he does, and we learn about man by what he does, not, usually not very good. So this whole thing is, in some sense, a study of God's plan, which is not that difficult. He starts out with Gentiles from Adam. They're all Gentiles, and they all go to seed. He's got to destroy them in the flood, and he saves Noah and his family. So we have, in a sense, we have a reordering of the earth at that point, reconstituting the humanity, starting over, reset button, whatever you want to call it. Then we have Gentiles continuing, but now we have Gentiles under another program called the program of government. So the man can't govern himself. We find anarchy, which has resulted in the flood, destruction. But now we have man under some kind of management mechanism, which is management of himself by others, called government. And that goes on, and that goes into utter failure. And only one example we have of the failure there is the Tower of Babel between the flood and Abraham. But it's just representative of the characteristics of man. And from other extra-biblical sources, here we go, other extra-biblical sources, we know that the entire world was populated, settled in this period of time. All right? So we know that there's Egyptian artifacts in South America, for example, at 10,000-foot level at the lakes. And we find we have even pyramids in the United States and Indiana, shaped of pyramids. So we know from other places that the world was settled, all right? So we just don't have hardly any information in this period, except that man also failed in this mechanism of trying to become righteous, and all he does is become righteous in his own sight and disobeys God, which the Tower of Babel is an example of that. Then we have another reordering of things. This time it's a reordering of humanity. Reordering of the earth has to do with physical things and management of the world. But in the reordering of humanity, God gives up on the group, and he goes to one man. And he can't even trust one man. So what he has to do with that one man is give him a promise and make that unilateral, unconditional with Abraham, that what he wants to accomplish has got to be accomplished through him. You can't let it to him alone. So to me, it's a major turning point in the history of man at this point, as there is with the flood. The flood maybe seems more dramatic, but when you say that God, in a sense, throws away all others except Abraham, and to keep Abraham, he's got to make a promise to him that Abraham can't even break. We have got a totally different system of way God deals with man than we've had before. So it's into this fray that Melchizedek shows up. So I think in my system, the way I look at it, is we don't have Melchizedek up there in a cloud floating. You know, like it looks like he is in Hebrews. It looks like that's what he's doing, with no beginning and no end, no attachment to this line. He's just out there. Well, I'm going to show to you that that was purposefully done. But that doesn't necessarily reflect the reality of who he is. So his reality of who he is has got to be in that line. He is a human being in that line. Because it is, after all, Abraham is blessed by this man, and Abraham blesses this man. So there's something happens in the exchange of these two men at Salem, in Jerusalem, in the Valley of the Kings, Kidron Valley, where it joins with the valley from the east, from the west, the Hinnom Valley, that place, and Rogel is the place, the spring of Rogel is where this occurs. All right, so the baton gets passed from that earlier system to the new system. All right, that's what I think, why it has to be Seth. Now I'll explain a little more than that, but I think it has to be Seth to make that connection. Because Melchizedek by himself, as it says in Hebrews, does not make that connection for us, and it has its purposes why it doesn't make it, which is what I'm going to show you, I hope. Now, I told you what I'm going to tell you, and I'm going to tell you what I'm going to tell you. Okay, last week, we have this left over. As I said, I started out to do a little bit of it, but it ended up being the whole lesson. So we take a step back to discuss Abram and Melchizedek. The connection of these two men is important. I've just sort of laid that out for you. The contact bridges or carries the plan of God, which is that thing you see on the board, homely as it is, plan of God forward into a new era, which leaves the Gentiles behind, not forgotten or forsaken forever, but for the time being, leaves them behind, and we move into the Jewish promises era. Called Abraham, not called a Jew yet, but he's the beginning of the Jewish family. And to him are given these promises. So this is what I have on the board for you. Don't need to explain that again. I call it God, a study in time, man, a study in time. And we do learn a lot about ourselves. We learn a lot about God when we study this part of Genesis. Agreed, nowhere in the Bible is the personal identification of Melchizedek explicitly made. Hands down, doesn't make it. However, last week we suggested a plausibility to, most likely, probability of Shem, the second son of Noah, as being Melchizedek. Now, it's likely, probability, not proof. But this identification brings an objection with the reading of the book of Hebrews, where it says, "For this Melchizedek, king of Salem, priest of the Most High God, who met Abraham as he was returning from the slaughter of the kings and blessed him, to whom also Abraham apportioned a tenth of all the spoils, was first of all, by the translation of his name, title, King of Righteousness, then also, number two, King of Salem, which is King of Peace." Bible explains it to us, thank you. Number three, here's the problem, "without father, without mother, without genealogy, having neither beginning of days nor end of life, but made like or appeared like or likened unto the Son of God." Okay, so that's where our problem is. It looks like this guy doesn't have any family. Without any genealogy, it looks like he doesn't have a beginning, doesn't have any end. So it can't be somebody we know. Okay, so we think. So Melchizedek is without genealogy. True in Hebrews. True in Hebrews. But in a visit to Genesis, might be able to shed some light on his personage. In Hebrews, there is no beginning or end. Surely does not mean, and no one that I know believes this, that he had none. Nor does it mean that Melchizedek had no parents. No one believes that. The point is that none are recorded in Hebrews. Now, the focus of this mystery, this unknown person, no family, no connection, no beginning, no end, the focus of this ministry, the identification of Melchizedek, is held back on purpose in order to make a larger point that Jesus, the Messiah, will be a priest of a new order in the kingdom. Now, Jesus has lineage, but of his priesthood, but his priesthood is from a lineage that does not spring from Aaron, the only one the Jews knew. So that's why this is kind of a new thing. They would say priesthood. Of course, Aaron hasn't come on the scene yet, but if the people would read later on back, they would wonder, well, this has to be the Aaron, beginning of the Aaron's priesthood. No, 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 it's not. It's totally different. That's the point. Totally different. His identification is held back, you know, in order to make a larger point, which is his independence. The parallel or analogy is that Melchizedek was a forever priest of the Most High God. So will the returning Son of God be a forever priest pattern after that order, not the Aaronic order. That is, a forever priest that has no beginning or end is of the Most High God. I don't think we have any arguments so far. But revealing the genealogy and exact identification of the person, now think about Hebrews now, but revealing the genealogy and the exact identification of the person would ruin the image of Melchizedek being painted for the Hebrews. If he appears just as another man, then for what purpose? His identification is concealed in Hebrews. Hebrews doesn't want you to think about his beginning and his end or his parentage. That's not the point of it. It's going to ruin it if you do. So with these limiting statements in Hebrews, are we to understand that we have no way of tying this super important person into the lineage or linkage of God's plan, which is what I'm doing on the board over here. I'm tying him into a plan. Because he doesn't float out there by himself. God doesn't float stuff out there. It's got to be part of the bigger picture. So with these limiting statements in Hebrews, are we to understand that we have no way of tying this super important person into the lineage or linkage of God's plan, the plan that now takes up with Abraham? Now, it's true, which some might say, well, we don't need any other linkage. We just go from Shem, which is the off the ark, and the godly line could just follow down through these. I was going to set my pointers up, but I didn't do that. But anyway, through Peleg and Reu and then Serug and Nahor, Terah to Abraham. So, you know, but the problem, there's a problem with if that's the line we're tracing here, that's not the line we're tracing here. True, if Abraham is a descendant of Shem, that's true. So he's got blood of Shem in him. But there are 9 generations between Shem and Abraham with Eber as an idol worshiper in the beginning of this. He's the last of the longevity patriarchs. Eber, I can point, you can see him. So this break in the linkage hardly makes this the spiritual linkage. There has to be another one that doesn't follow this spiritual linkage. Are you with me on that? So this linkage, if you take this list and say, well, that's the godly line, let's call it that way, the godly line through which promises will come, bloodline, that would be true because they're all descendants of each other, but the linkage itself doesn't have the spiritual qualities that it should have, that we would see like with Melchizedek, who is a believer, no doubt. Now, again, no one believes that Melchizedek did not have parents or that he lived forever. He died like everybody else does. But those missing facts could have been given. Only shows the very purpose of making him appear as if out of nowhere. This is for illustrative purposes as a priest like unto the Most High God. Now, once the illustration has been drawn in Hebrews, let's get that in our head. Once we understand that, then the next step, it is fair to ask the question, well, then who is this person? We're not going to destroy what we already established as the illustration. But we can still ask the next question, well, then who is this person? It no longer needs concealing because we know the purposes of Hebrews that's been established. Now, the word gods is sort of, I don't know if I get into this, get people confused with this, but the word God sometimes, if I think about how my mom would have taught me, he said there would have been gods with a capital G and there are no other gods. And I said, well, that's probably right because all the other gods are idols and so forth. But the Bible doesn't really talk that way about it. There are gods that are human beings. In fact, we have an example of that. The leaders of Israel in Psalms are called gods, small g, because they are put in power. Thus, they are sons of the Most High. They're sons by virtue of their authority. This does not deify these men, but sets them a notch above their subjects. So the gods, quote, in terms, the gods term, is used as in authorities of the Most High. Now here we have Psalm 82, verse 6 says, I said, you are God. He's talking to human beings here, by the way. You are gods, and all of you are sons of the Most High. Nevertheless, you die. See, they're not deity, they die, but still called gods. And because all men, and I said put that in the word in like men or like all men, die and fall like any one of the princes. So the princes obviously are human. So what I'm pointing out to you is that sometimes the word gods are used of humans. Okay? Now we have this from Bible Knowledge's commentary, makes the same point. God warned about Psalm 82. God warned the wicked judges that they will perish. He had appointed them as gods, as sons of the Most High, his representatives on earth. So now we could have a Melchizedek as a god, because he represents of the Most High, because he is in this pattern a ruler of men. Okay, that shouldn't confuse us. I don't think it's just the way sometimes we don't want to denigrate the word God with a capital G. Okay, now consider the parents of the first four generations outliving their children. The red, see, they all outlived their children. I don't, my pointer doesn't work this morning here, but you know, here we see it down here. These men, these old men, and there are very old men, were considered gods. Now, some of this comes from outside of Scripture as well. I mean, we have it in our script, in the Psalm, I said 82, but if you look at extra biblical writings, they talked about these people as gods, not meaning deity, but they were higher authorities. All right. So we have these guys, these four generations through Eber, who are long livers, they live a long time, and they outlive their children. So when you look at Abraham, he looked up to his grandpa Nahor, and he's got two more generations to go before he gets to Eber, and he don't even know who those people are, in a sense. We wouldn't know who they are. We can't really get past our grandparents. So these people lived a long, long time, and they hung around a long, long time, and people knew them as gods. They're gods of the Most High God. So, of all the gods, they were the Most High. All right, not confused with deity here, not at all. Now, Shem is old. His community at Shem, at Salem, where Jerusalem is, had long ago lost track of his lineage, his age, his history. Now, this is the way the Hebrew looks at it, Hebrews. What remained is his authority acquired by his being ancient, a god. This set him apart from all the others. He being ancient, they considered him as one from the Most High God. He's the oldest of the oldest, because no one could match his credentials. So it is easy pickings for the Hebrew writer to take that image and teleport it into the first century exactly in the same way that the community of Salem would have seen Shem as the priest, the king of righteousness of the Most High God. And I can reread this too again, without father, without mother, without genealogy, having neither days or end of life, but made in the likeness or in the facsimile like the Son of God, he remains a priest perpetually. That's the point is being made there. So the writer of Hebrews goes back to Old Testament, picks up the picture, the illustration, brings it forward. And by the way, he adds now stuff to it that's not in Genesis. We'll talk about that in a minute. So did Abraham know he was, what did Abraham know and when did he know it? Okay, did Abraham know who he was dealing with? Question. Perhaps first, no, don't know, hard to tell. But when Abraham gives tithes to Melchizedek, when he gives him tithes after he makes, you know, has these victories, gives tithes to Melchizedek, it is apparent at that point that he recognizes this someone as someone superior to him. If not only just that he's older, but there's more to it than that, I think. Else, why would he be giving him these gifts? So would Abraham give these gifts to an unconnected, total stranger he met in the desert? Not likely. A safer place would be that there was a recognition of his personage and the role he, Melchizedek, has in bringing God's righteousness to earth. He, after all, was the king of righteousness. To this, Abraham acknowledges his inferiority and pays tithes. Now the connection. Melchizedek in turn blesses Abraham and the mantle is passed. And that's what I think is the middle of that circle. Without that event, we have no connection with Adam. We have no connection with Noah. And this makes that connection. Now again, it doesn't say it, spell it out, but I'm working from a model that we probably all agree with. And so it has to fit the model unless our model is wrong. So Melchizedek, in turn, blesses Abraham, and I say the mantle is passed. And I added my own words here, and I think all the necessary documentation that comes back from Adam is passed on to Abraham in time. I'm not sure they did it in there by the spring of Enrogel, but in time, because Abraham, Melchizedek, outlives, or Shem, outlives Abraham by 35 years. So they had lots of time that they could have passed this on over. And Melchizedek knew that he wouldn't live forever. In fact, Abraham's going to die before Melchizedek does, but Abraham's going to have sons. They're called Isaac, and they're going to be Jacob. And these guys would be guys that would have carried on. They would have kept them with them and would have finally passed them on to Moses. Now, that's a plausible. Now, we do this to some extent because of one rule we have. We have this Christianity. Christians have is that the rule of the economy of miracles. The rule goes this way. If God can do it in any other way than a miracle, he'll do it. You just jump in and do it. So when I say that Moses wrote, he worked from manuscripts that were already prepared earlier. He didn't have to start with nothing. Then you have all the problems of all these people didn't know anything about God until Moses wrote. That can't be either. All right, so we just say that. So, you know, the idea that these documents got passed on to Melchizedek, to Abraham, and so forth is plausible and probably the right answer. Still not convinced, probably. I'm not trying to convince you. I just thought it was funny. Now, there are a limited number of candidates, if you don't like my choices so far, there are a limited number of candidates for Melchizedek. He can't be somebody that was created for this job. I mean, just out of nowhere, no parents. He's got parents. So there are a limited number of candidates for Melchizedek. Obviously, we have to pick one of the descendants of Noah, don't we? There's nobody else living except those that got off the boat and their children. It will have to be one of who is still alive the time of Abraham. That limits a lot of people already. Because remember, except these four guys from Eber on up, they're still alive at the time of Abraham. But a lot of those guys earlier than Abraham already have died. So, you know, just like kind of we have, the parents outlive their children. So that started happening after Eber. So all we have to do is to pick one who is still alive at the time of Abraham's entering to the land. That's where I would put it, at the entering to the land, or sometime after, because he had to, you know, defeat the kings first, and then he met with Melchizedek. So I have the date 2151 is the date that some don't use, but Mr. Pilkey, who I'm using, is his date. Now, I think I'll look for candidates here. The green line is about the time when Abraham entered the line. See it over here, the green line? You're not colorblind, are you? All right, the green line. They drive up on it, so he hits Shem up there. Middle down here is about where Abraham entered the land at 75. He lives another 100 years about. So I could even been over a little bit further to the left from where I have it. So the green line is about the time when Abraham entered the land. Likely he did not meet Melchizedek until a few years later after the battle with the kings and the separation from Lot, which, by the way, is a very important reduction. Abraham didn't give it to Lot. God didn't give it to Abraham and Lot. God gave it to Abraham, and he had to wait to get Terah out of the way and get Lot out of the way. Now we can deal with Abraham. So that happened here. So we rule out Eber as the guy that could be Melchizedek because he was an idol worshiper. It can't be him. And from him down, you think that all the children of him would have been idol worshippers as well. So we lost godliness with Eber or sooner. So those guys can't be. So we're down to just a few candidates here. At this point, we must resort to the plan of God as it works out in history. And the line, we all agree, is the line is from Adam to Noah to Shem to Abraham to David to Christ. So a reasonable hypothesis is that God's work will be in that line, not outside in another unattached line or person. Now, that may be just common sense to me. Now, maybe you say, well, I think God could do whatever he wants to do. Yes, he can, but he doesn't do stuff he doesn't need to do. He can do it very easily within the line that he's promised. Now, the key to unlock the lock. This is probably where the division of the parties go. Until recently, it has been a universally held position that Melchizedek is an unknown, unnamed person because there was no overlapping connection with Noah's family. It is held that they would have died off long ago without any possibility of there being any connection between Melchizedek and Shem, for example. Shem is gone a long time ago. Abram comes on. No way that they could have had any contact. All right? Now, by the way, this is Whitcomb's position. However, since recent times, I'm going to just guess 1980, approximately as far as I know, there are no more deeper time biblicists who are writing of deeper time for Genesis. The chart here on the right is an example of what you will see if you go to the internet and look at it. This is what you see all the time. The chart here is an example of what you will see from many authors. The overlaps may vary some. Pilkey is one that I like better because his is the only one that's consistent. I mean, you know, does the whole thing. That's just part of it. Some overlaps may be different than this, but they are basically quite consistent. Now, we have to decide, is it reasonable, consistent with all we know about God and his interwoven plan, roughly sketched on the board, to assume a high probability or surety that Melchizedek is Shem? It's a choice. Give it a rating of 1 to 10. Or does it have a low probability from 1 to 10? And I suppose, and I will let you make your own choice. You can still come to my class if you give it a 1 or a 10. I don't care how you do it. I'm just presenting it how I think it. Now remember, if you choose deeper time, that there are gaps in the genealogies, no evidence that there are, but let's say you do, somehow by some trick, there are some, and there is no overlap, then you are frozen in your choice. It can't be Melchizedek. It cannot be because there's no overlap. You have no other option. So I wanted you to know, if you choose that, you're stuck with that choice. And you got to make that choice, not because you chose that, but because that's the system you chose. Okay, now, Melchizedek is not known in Hebrews by a connection with the flood event on purpose. But remember that such a connection is not thereby denied. It is not appropriate to the purpose in Hebrews to use the Genesis information. It would ruin the point of a timeless priest. So he doesn't use it. Therefore, the missing identification is entirely consistent, and I say justifiable. Okay, I'm glad we're going to get to this point. I thought we'd have to rush through this, so I'm going to explain something to you here. Now, we have a way of explaining New Testament's use of the old, and in our case of Melchizedek, New Testament use of the old. New Testament writers use Old Testament information. Melchizedek is in the Old Testament, but he also appears in the New Testament with some mystery. Not in the Old Testament, but in the New Testament, whoever this is, there's a mystery with him. That is, the old and new accounts, in this case, do not correspond or necessarily correspond with each other. The New Testament doesn't have to say exactly the same thing the Old Testament says. And if they say something different, it doesn't mean they just do. There are a lot of times this happens. So I'm just going to suggest to you, in the Old Testament, we have Genesis, gives you this story. We've read it before. And on the right, this is what's added by the Hebrew writer. It says, without father, without mother, without genealogy, and neither beginning of days or end of life. That's not in Genesis. That's in Hebrews. Okay? Now, which is it? Which is right? Well, I said, this new material, somehow I scratched my head a little bit. Said, now, wait a minute, how can this be? Why doesn't that, why, I could send that. That would have been Genesis. They would have quoted Genesis, would have put it in there. No, this is added material that's not in Genesis. So we call this, got a new word for you, inspired census plenary application. I know, big words. Let me explain. How do you account for this addition that we just saw in the writer of Hebrews? Is he breaking the rule that he is not accurate in citing the Old Testament? Well, not really. This happens a lot of times in the Old Testament. In fact, I have Robert Thomas's little page on it, and then he has, this is a small print over here, but these are examples, and there's like two passages, you know, bounced off each other. And I didn't look any of them up. I had enough material. But he gives examples where this happens all the time in the Old Testament using the Old Testament, New Testament using the Old Testament. So this happens a lot of times in the Old Testament where the writers go beyond, New Testament writers, go beyond what was given in the Old Testament. Sometimes they expand on what's in the Old Testament. We just saw that. And even to the point of making a totally different point. Now, again, we do this all the time. I thought of a little phrase that said, the stitch in time saves, nine. All right. Can anybody tell me who said that first? Your mother. All right, that's a possibility. Do we use it without knowledge of its beginning? Why? Does that fit what we're trying to say? You know, let's say the stitch in time saves nine meant for some seamstress somewhere that was darning somebody's socks, and it figured if I put in a stitch now and close the hole, it'll save me nine later. I can suppose that. I don't know that. But that doesn't keep me from using that picture and explaining something to our kids, like they better do this now or else it'll be worse later. You know, I don't know what, I can't imagine anything like that would affect a child, but if you don't save your money now, you won't have any later or worse, and it's not a good, and you think of your own ones. So I'm seeing here, the Bible does something here that's common in the way we express it. Think nothing of it when we express it, but when the Bible does it, whoa, you can't do that. He changed the Bible. No. So we have these sayings in the Old Testament that the New Testament writers, under inspiration, that's the word inspired here, is there. Not everybody can do this. It's only those that were inspired can do this. You can't do it. I can't do it. Better not do it. Try not do it. Because it's under inspiration that this happens. So the New Testament doesn't have to correspond exactly with the Old, is what I'm saying. Because the New Testament writer can expand on, and the writer to the Hebrews just did. He just told us that he's without father, without mother, without genealogy, neither beginning of days, end of life. It's not in the Old Testament. It's in the New Testament. So I think it's Robert Thomas's rule of inspired census, the general sense of things, full sense of things, and it's applied. So the application is applied to an Old Testament, a New Testament passage. Now, in this case, the writer of Hebrews has his purpose to show Melchizedek as the beginning of a different line than Aaron, and he uses information, I'm talking about Hebrews writer here, he uses information that does not exist in Genesis. I wouldn't say he made it up, but he did. I mean, no one says he didn't have parents. He just says he didn't have parents, but he just made that up. But he can do this because he's an inspired writer, all right? So he uses this information that does not exist in Genesis account as a way of illustrating the new thought with no earthly lineage, just an illustration. By the way, only inspired writers have the authority to do this, and in case you want to try it, I heard one guy one time say, after a discussion we had on this, I can do it. I said, don't you dare try this. This is only under inspiration can you change the Old Testament into what the New Testament, how it wants to use it. So we have this example for Robert Thomas explains it as the inspired census plenary application, ISPA. I'm going to wow somebody with that this afternoon. Go ahead. So the ISPA, the New Testament writer, is using the Old Testament to make a point that may or may not fit the historical original. So, and I just explained it, census plenary means fuller sense application. Here with Melchizedek, the writer of Hebrews does that very thing. Allowing the identification of Melchizedek as allowing. Shem, sorry. Thank you. Okay, now, With hat in hand, I come to you and say, if you're looking for proof, I'm not going to find it here. I'm not going to bring you proof. But do I have plausibility? That's all I'm asking. That's all we have. And I might say at this point, if we study our theology very carefully, we have a lot of things that we hold true that are based on this kind of reasoning. So, is Melchizedek Shem? I guess it depends on who you ask.